I'm Alan Watt, and this is Cutting Through the Matrix on the 7th of June, 2020. And here we go, into the next stalling technique, I suppose you call it, which falls right on in with the COVID idea, the lockdown, the stopping of all commerce, the stopping of normal life, basically, mandated by our governments on behalf of the World Health Organization in this wonderful undemocratic system in which we live, because we don't vote for WHO. They're so corrupt and so literally compromised, everybody with it, with shares in big pharma companies, some of them even, you know, owners of some of them, really, when you look at it, and they get awfully handsomely rewarded for giving contracts out to them, taxpayer contracts, naturally. We fund everything for the global elite. And it was amazing, too, and I'll make touch on this tonight, is so everything just fits together rather neatly, really, in amongst the chaos, the appearance of chaos, because don't forget that the World Economic Forum said last year that we weren't listening to them. Not we, the peasantry, you know, the world's peasantry, the peasantry that can't go to the WEF, and we're not invited, basically, and you couldn't afford it anyway. Because the WEF is just part of the superstructure that rules us. You don't see any Antifa protesting them. There's a clue in all this, you see. There's lots of clues in everything. Long time ago, I noticed that the Canadian government was funding far-left communist groups in Canada for their clubs, where they could sing their protest songs and scheme their little anti-war rallies, which were all fine at the time, was pretty well passive compared to today. But we funded them across the country. Most folk don't even know it. But I thought at the time, you know, when it was the anti-war idea in Britain and Canada and everywhere else across the planet, you had these mass rallies, the anti-war rallies, because we were sick of being told we're all going to get nuked, you see, and the war to end all wars and all civilization in the process. And because of it, that was the heyday, mind you, of the military-industrial complex for quick money, big money, from the taxpayer to save us all. They kept making new kinds of bombs and missiles and aircraft to carry them as well as individual missiles. But it was a heyday because no one complained at the time. But we all said, oh my God, they have to protect us against other guys across there. And a long, long time ago, when you're kind of growing up, I watched these kind of things too. Well-organized protest rallies. But they used to have families there, you know, when they had men, women, and children, you know. And you'd see the families, hundreds and thousands of families at times, with their banners up, very quiet and peaceful, just protesting against this and that and the whole thing. Because no one wanted to get blown up, you see. But when you think of the money, too, that could have been used, help people, they never really think about it. The money that could be used on programs and business to get more business, more jobs, and the rest of it, went to the military industrial complex year after year after year to keep us safe. But what I noticed was that it suddenly stopped, you see. It was a very quick turn, like a turn of a switch. And I knew, because I met some of them in Canada, some of the left wings asked me to sing at some a few things. I hadn't really a clue that it was that radical at the time, until I met a communist who was from England and who was from this, he'd just been over to the Soviet Union, and he came over after a concert, a general concert, and started talking to this little group there, and I guess he thought I was one of them. But he's talking about the next move to network amongst all radical groups. And at the time, too, he said he came back from Moscow, and he says that we must now, he says, get all the other fringe groups in with us. That meant the gay groups and all the rest of it, too. And there were some eyebrows raised at that. But he says, well, we've got to do it, he says. We've got to get everybody we can get on board for protesting and for future. But I thought, this guy was from London, England. Someone could come in and out of Canada and every other country with impunity. And don't tell me the authorities didn't know who he was, that he was there organizing the overthrow of governments and things like that. And I thought, it's obvious, this is run by your governments are part of it, and this guy was part of it. He had no fear. I asked him, I said, aren't you worried about getting caught coming into a country? He's talking about, no. He said, I do it all the time. So you start to see that there's big players here, and there's little players, and there's followers. The whole thing of any big uprising depends on followers. Followers never get what they want. I won't even go into the States at the moment, but followers never get what they want. It's always for a better tomorrow. It's always young people too, where everything's black and white. That's how you see things. There's no grey areas of life. Everything's just right or wrong. And it's easy. It's always easy with youngsters to point out that the nasty things in life is very comprehensible. Oh, that's terrible. That's terrible. And they're cutting down the trees, etc. And they keep, as I say before, they've always shown the same clear-cut stuff from the late 40s, which doesn't happen today. But that doesn't matter. See, once you radicalize, facts don't matter. They're opposing facts. And they're fed a steady diet in this at school from the age of five or even younger if you go to kindergarten, of how bad people are. Because that's the agenda. Don't forget the World Economic Forum comprised the top business people of the planet, the multi-billionaire, trillionaire, and CEOs are in charge of a lot of these big corporations on behalf of the owners. Above everything, there's always another group and another group above everything. That's how you find things really work. Now, we're owned. I always say we're owned. I have no problem saying that we're owned. Your very thoughts are owned. They're given to you by somebody else, generally. Brzezinski said that, a man who should certainly have known, because that was his job, was to give you your thoughts to whole nations, in fact. The Brzezinski, who also went over to Afghanistan, remember, years ago, and I put up the video where he's giving a talk to the tribesmen there, in Taliban, and he's because when the US wanted them to fight against the Russia, which ruled over it then, occupied it. And there's Brzezinski, with his fist up in the air, using the revolutionary move, just the clenched fist. So wherever you see that, you should really be very careful what's behind it all. So here's a guy who represents the Trilateral Commission and the Council on Foreign Relations, you see. A technocrat placed there. And he said to the Taliban, he says, your cause is a holy war, a just war, a jihad. And that's what he told them. And next thing you know, he's back there in America, once they get the war going against Russia, telling that giving the strategy to the CFR and other groups too, as to how we should shape the minds of the next generation that's going to come up, with, and not just in the US, but across the world. Don't forget, the CFR is an international organization. It's only part of the same organization that runs the world, the Royal Institute for International Affairs. And they've got a branch called the European Institute for International Affairs. They dropped the royal part because every politician in the EU Parliament is a member of it. You see, from all countries. They got one group for the Far East and Pacific Rim group. And these are the same groups, remember, who manipulate behind the scenes all the wars that come and go. Right? The skirmishes, the real wars. And so. They proudly boast about it in their own archives that Carl Quigley was the historian for a while. He was a professor. And he believed in it all. He was completely on board with it. He said he disagreed with some of its methods. And he also thought that its importance in shaping history for about 100 years, pretty well, from the late 1880s anyway, onwards, that he was taking it from. He said it was so important if the public only knew that the whole history had been shaped and fomented all the different things that happened, the big wars, and that, to bring a global society in, you see, a proper managed society. It wasn't supposed to be democratic. That's what people have. Democracy is a con game to get everybody on board for particular periods of the big agenda, you see. It's not meant to be real. And it's used for revolution. And revolution is when you speed up the process of what the elite want. That's the beauty of this con game. But anyway, Brzezinski said that. He said that the movers and shakers themselves, you see, the ones behind the scenes that say, okay, we need a little war over here. And it's the Hegelian dialectic. Most folk don't want to change anything in their lives. They really don't. Even the teenagers you'll see rioting right now and looting the stores, they might think they know what they want at the time. They might think that. But once in their mid-20s and towards 30, they start to just wean off and they get a bit fed up with it. It doesn't matter where they've settled themselves in their mind or even their financial strata or whatever. They start to get kind of comfortable. And just were routines. And they also become a bit jaded from you start to learn there's grey areas in between the black and white reasons for everything, you see. Things that they used to criticize their dad or their mum doing, like getting divorced, they might do it themselves. And they can rationalize it, so they can start rationalizing it for their parents as well. Whereas before, when they're younger, they may be furious at both of them or one or the other because the parents would split up. But then they go and do the same themselves. In other words, experience of life, especially in this chaos of this modern life, manufactured chaos, doesn't give them much of a chance to be different, you see. And they settle in their little areas, I say. And then they don't want to change too much. So by that time, the elite have already radicalized the upcoming generation. You take over. And then the ones who used to be the previous radicalized ones who are now becoming sedentary and happy or is content and or accepting of their lot or whatever, get annoyed by the younger group coming up. That's how the technique is done, you see. So because you get settled in your ways, you can't get the big changes made on behalf of the rulers, you see. So they create what they call it the thesis. Here's what we are. Here's what we do. So you got to, and as long as that goes on, nothing's going to change. You might have quite a happy society if you left it that way, you see. But so you create something that's going to go against what it stands for. So that's your antithesis. So now you've got a competing argument, or an argument started, and then they go at it. And out of it, you guide what you really were after in the first place, if you're the elite managers. And that's the synthesis, what comes out of the argument, the agreement. Okay, we'll agree with this, and we'll do this, and we'll so you've got your initial change. The communism is based on this, the dialectic. And out of that synthesis, you say, oh, well, so you're happy for a little while, but immediately they're starting again. Now we've got the synthesis now becomes the new thesis. And then you come out with the antithesis, you see. And you keep going with this constant, that's pure Marxism, basically, and Trotskyism, the way it's designed for constant change, you see, plan change. And you always decide what the change is going to be. And so you start the argument yourself, and you take it from there. That's just basic stuff. So you always have to train a new group of radicalized youngsters, idealistic, and make sure you own all the school systems and so on, so that they're brought up watching the furry little animals, you see, that are hunting for a place to live, you see. And there's man, terrible man, destroying it. According to every documentary you'll see, that's what it's supposed to be, you see. It's supposed to radicalize the youngsters. And they use the same footage, as I say, and techniques across the whole planet. Because the whole planet is under UNICEF and so on, and under basically a global curriculum. Bill Gates is involved. He's calling it the new virtual education, basically. He hopes he can lock us down for longer by any technique. It doesn't matter if it's rights or whatever, as long as and then they can start learning at home, basically, on the computer. And of course, he'll be in charge of the curriculum because he had big input on the present curriculum, the Common Core thing. So make sure you standardize everyone's education or indoctrination. It depends how what we are giving them, you see. Education should really always have arguments about pretty well everything, and you don't get that really, do you? You should be able to look at everything from all kinds of points of view, but you're not really given that. You're given a Marxist technique of critical theory. That's what they use in the schools. But let's not look at that when William the Conqueror came in. Well, think about the people who were not fitting into society. How would it affect them? And that kind of thing, you see. Social engineering, to me, it radicalizes a youngster. It's quite... You can create... Why do you think cartoons work with youngsters? The Soviets used cartoons to a great extent, not just for children, but right into adulthood. And people could even cry with the poor character in the cartoon losing their home because of the bad capitalist and stuff like that. They can be so perfect, the techniques that were used. It's a lot cheaper than using Hollywood, like we did in the West. But children don't have much of a chance, and they're the greatest targets for propaganda. They don't know it. The parents don't know it. But that's the best, because what do you think is always different? The parents say, I can't relate to my children. We're not meant to relate to them. The rulers of the planet have already changed even the techniques of basic mathematics, so you can't help the children. It's been like that for the last 60, 70 years, at least. Maybe further back, from the days of John Dewey. Because that was the techniques. Don't let the parents have any influence over the child. You want the child to say, oh, that's my dad or my mum, if they still have them. And so they'll look upon them as some kind of obsolete artifact that just feeds them and gives them money. That's what Bertrand Russell basically said. Add a little bit, but that's basically what he said. The only function for the parent eventually will be to feed and clothe the child and look after its needs, basically. And the state will give them the indoctrination or the education and their values for the new system. Well, here you are. This is how it's done. It's not meant basic mathematics, there's no reason they can do it. Well, here's long division. Here's a different way of doing it. Why? It's so the parent can say, I can help the child. The child might start to respect the parent. You don't want that bond there. That's why it's done. That's really why it's done, I'm not just guessing at this. And the same with so much more, too. They started to get rid of the older teachers back in about the 70s and 80s. They really sped up. And in the 90s, woof. And so you got more and more young ones. More young ones. And they wanted primarily women. Because they know, with their psychology and their behaviorism and all their studying of the little people, all the little characters, which is us, that young children have a greater bond with their mum, you see, for years, but as opposed to the daddy. And so they got younger women in too, younger teachers in. And then in came the toolkits to indoctrinate. They call them toolkits for groupthink. You want every child in a group, in the classroom, the common groups now, every child to come out with the same opinion on every topic, you see, the authorized opinion. And the teacher, if the teacher is good, can actually go along through the toolkit. Oh, he's a little stubborn boy over here. How do I get that stubborn boy to agree with this particular topic and what we want? We've decided, like democratically decided, hold your hands up and say, are you on or with it or without it or against it or whatever? And there you go. And how to even ostracize them from the group, make them feel insecure or kind of bad or something, you see, shame them. Which again comes right into adult life, because once you've been taught to be shamed, you see, like a dunce. These dunces in old days. and the group goes ha ha and points at you like you're a fool, then that'll stay with you all through your adult life. And they know that because you're supposed to be shamed now for your entire adult life. You see it getting done now. Shaming, all kinds of shaming, you know. Yeah. Psychology, eh? Psychology, psychiatry, behaviorism, all these things working together. And they prepare the children who don't have a chance. They have no chance at all to be an individual who can think critically for themselves anymore. Everything's got to be emotive, yeah. Attach an emotion to everything, you see. Either right, wrong, or shame, or anger, whatever it happens to be, make sure you attach it. And then you've got a slave for life. You'll never know they're a slave. And then when you call them out to radicalize about this, that, or whatever, they'll go. Just like cannon fodder. They haven't got a clue. That's managed that way. But isn't it odd? Isn't it odd that here we are, after months of being locked down with pretty well a pretty mild virus, pretty well, eh? Which was hyped out of all proportion, like a horror movie. You lived through a horror movie, only it was daily and it was called news. And all the newscasters and all the news organizations were on board with it immediately. Once the button was pushed, you know, just before March, just about beginning of March, when they really pushed it, hype, terror. And we had to build up to it beforehand. We showed you all the China stuff. My God, they're spraying the whole air atmosphere with this stuff and this spray across the hundreds of feet high, eh? Well, if it's hundreds of feet high, it killed it off. Why, you know, what was all this 6 feet apart sort of idea? It had nothing to do with anything, actually, except training you into stupidity and into non-social patterns of behaviour. So the preparation went on, and then suddenly, and in the same media, they were lambasting people at the beginning, saying, you see what's happening in China? How come you're not talking about it? You know, have you seen what's happening there? And, of course, it was when a switch was turned in one day and they all went into action on the same day. Every news outlet, every TV show and so on, apparently. I don't have TV, but I get all the little clips through internet and the links are sent to me and so on. As I've said before, the media was in the doldrums for years because internet pretty well put them out of business, a lot of them. And then they turned from basic news to paid subscriptions, right? And even then, they were taking the same information off the net like everybody else. The day of the roving reporter was pretty well gone. And they laid off their staff. I don't think the staff, really, reporters now were taught really proper journalistic procedures and techniques and so on. And everybody was compromised, you see. Here's your right-wing papers, and here's your left-wing news outlet. You know, and this is how it's done. As a child, I used to know, how come you've got always, every country has got a star, you know, which is a left, and that's your five-point star, the same red star, of course, they had in the Soviet Union on their caps and uniforms, you see. But in the light side, you're in the light side, you had sun, it was always the sun. And you had Mercury and things like that, and couriers, and everything was so black and white, wasn't it? And folk never really quite got it. But people would go into automatically, and that'd be their newspaper for life, whatever party they belonged to. And even the left-wing paper, and people couldn't figure it out, except, well, they did actually, my grandpa's age. They pretty well knew that the big moguls in media, you never trusted them because they were the richest characters really in the country, a lot of them. You had British lords that owned slews of newspapers, like you know, and monopolies, basically, of hundreds of papers across the world. And true enough, even Quigley talked about the same thing, Carl Quigley, that that these media barons would get together when it came to World War time and have their meetings and decide how to terrify the public. That he actually put that in his book, eh? How to terrify the public, get them to really hate whatever enemy is going to be before the enemy's even fired a shot. So that's what they do. It hasn't changed. But when it went into like overdrive, suddenly, but oh my God, the coronavirus, eh? And lockdown, and oh, this is horrible. We're all going to die, they said, eh? And the only hope, Fauci said at the very beginning, eh, on behalf of himself and the WHO and the pharma companies and vaccine companies, well, there's no hope here at all except for a vaccine. You might have to be locked down until we get a vaccine. There was no talk, or no whiff of ever getting natural immunity, as we've always got against every other virus that's ever existed. You know, no trace of that. First in history, no trace of your own immune system. And even when the people had tested positive for having had it, right, they had antibodies in their bloodstream. Even for those who say, well, they might not last very long. Well, if that wouldn't last very long, their own antibodies, why would your vaccination, which is supposed to stimulate your body to create antibodies, why would that make better of your own antibodies than your own antibodies? Wouldn't they? It's meant to stimulate your body to create antibodies, right? So if you've already done it, what's wrong with that? Nothing makes sense. When nothing makes sense, there's a big con going on in this world of conology. And getting back to the World Economic Forum, where all the big moguls and big pharma companies, everybody who's anybody running us all, in public-private enterprises, because every big corporation on the planet has got its hands out to every country they're involved with for handouts, massive gifts from the taxpayer. That's what it's all about. And so they said, yeah, the people are not listening to it. We'll have to scare them pretty well, eh? How can we force them to be post-industrial, post-consumerism, post-free trade, not just free trade, but post-service economy? Back in the 90s, I talked about the service economy. It was discussed widely in Britain under the guise of the common market, which became the economic union of Europe, eh? Well, it's just a little meeting place where people will meet and discuss little trade differences and things. That's what they tried to sell the public on in Britain for years, until the word free trade came in, you see. Free trade. And in with the free trade came the gradual abolition of taxes for imports. Now, all countries even the States, I think, used to get pretty well all of its taxes, its main taxes for the federal government, for the country, from imports. And those import duties, you called it. Most countries survived that way. Well, with the gradual introduction of free trade, as it might to call it, you see, it's free for the big corporations who do the exporting into other countries. But guess what happens? When you're not getting money from import duties, from taxes, from imports, you've got to make up the money from the taxpayer, the usual slob at the bottom. And that's exactly what's been happening ever since. That's the beauty of free trade. It lets the big corporations pay nothing, you see, as they flog their goods across the planet. Although they actually moved it all to China to be the manufacturer of the planet pretty well. And then they can export it to all of you without you paying anybody paying import duty. That's what the whole fracas is about right now. China's starting to put more slap more taxes on imports into China. But it's called a service economy. Oh, if a service economy, because not only would we start to eliminate all import duties, you'll have to start to accept so many products from all the members. Different members will put quotas on things. And if you make so much, if your farmers continue making butter and milk, we're going to dump a lot of it because we've agreed to buy a lot from Europe and France especially. And it put staggering amounts of intergenerational families of farmers out of business by these darn bureaucrats, honestly, you know. Mm-mm. I mentioned Heartland, a great movie before, with Anthony Hopkins, and it's well worth watching based on the fact, not just for one family, but many of them. And once you got bureaucrats running things, nightmare time. However, that's what they did. Oh, you're a service economy. You got to accept stuff. So before you know it, almost all your goods are made by outside companies in countries, and they're bringing it into your country tax-free. You're getting taxed more and more to make up for the fact that there's no import duties coming in for it to the countries anymore. And you're in a service account. You buy stuff in, you pass it around from the importers to the middlemen, different layers of them down to the store owner, and that's your business, is just passing products made outside your country around. And the debates they had this in Britain years before you heard of the service economy in the West, the rest of the countries in the West. And the top economists at the time, even the 1970s, were saying, you know, that if you go into this system of service economy, eventually you accumulate so much and overwhelming debt, you'll go under, because the country's losing layer upon layer upon layer of taxation from because you're not making stuff from scratch anymore, from raw ore, for instance, for steel mills, and to the steel itself and the billets. They're then sold off in the factories that make things from the billets and metal, etc. These are all levels of taxation that the government would use. Well, again, the government loses out there, so guess who is taxed all the darn more? Well, the slob again at the bottom. But even so, eventually, you stagnate. Eventually, you have so much stuff coming in from abroad, and that you're not making money anymore in any kind of manufacturing, and you have a glut of material, especially when you take it off into places like China, such cheap labor, which the same people brought you free trade based on all their corporations. They moved them all there. And you have in the service economy, I likened to a dog that falls into a swimming pool and it paddles for as long as it can. That's a service economy, until it's exhausted and eventually it drowns. It can't get out. You know? That's what it is. And that's what's happening now, of course. That's exactly what's happening now. So, bingo, the WEF, with all the top corporations there, there's nobody, there's anybody doesn't go to it, you see. And we're nobody, so we can't go to it. It affects all of us. And the big corporations that shape our lives, you see, literally shape our lives, they all attend, they're all on board. They were on board like 20 years ago at the WEF for this whole agenda that we're into now, this part of it. What are we going to do? The people won't stop. You know, they're not bringing down their number. It's amazing how the WEF, you would think it's all business, but no. Every corporation there is into sustainability programs with the United Nations. Every one of them. They're all into the destruction of any kind of family unit. They're all for all kinds of new fad families, even though they won't last a lot. It doesn't matter. They don't want functioning families. They really don't. And that's the hardest thing to get your mind around. Why would the richest people on the planet and the representatives of the richest people on the planet, that's more like it actually, why would they all be on board with sustainability for the planet? And depopulation, austerity for a post-consumerist society, where you just have basic. Well, the thing is, and I wondered about it too. I says, well, you know, when they sold off the electric utilities, every country had their own infrastructure. This was essential infrastructure. You must have your own energy supplies, whether it's gas, electric, or whatever. Gasoline, you know, petrol in Europe, diesel, etc. You must have basic infrastructure and your hospital. These are all part of infrastructure, especially in Europe, but the hospitals too. Essential things that for a country to sustain itself through any possible catastrophe or a war even. I mean, Britain was starving from World War One right through the Great Depression into World War Two, and through it, and after it for a while. They learned, they certainly learned from World War One, and but they did the same thing in World War Two. They didn't have enough food produce on for rationing. They were so dependent on imported stuff. Well, that's free trade again. And Britain, remember, is the home of free trade. Well, London is the city of London, where it was all designed by the makers and shapers of the world, the Lord Alfred Milner Group. And so the whole idea of having your own infrastructure is essential for a functioning sovereign nation to survive and look after its people. And bit by bit, you watch it getting sold off, right? Especially since the free trade idea with Europe too, eventually it became, let's sell off the water supply to foreign companies. They've got nothing in common with you. Who are you going to complain to when there's not enough water or you can't afford it? Your government will say, well, we don't run that anymore. There's for private businesses and we've got nothing to do with them. Right? Or electricity, for instance, or even gas. You've had ongoing wars for quite a few years now against Russia and the old Soviet bloc countries. They were going to pipe gas all through Europe, plenty of gas, and right all the way even under the water and pipelines to Britain. And of course, you had big battles between the elite who rule Britain. A lot of them don't live in Britain, but they rule it anyway. And against the elite to basically from Russia. Big battles over pipelines. The Middle East is the same thing. Before they invaded, and we invaded Iraq and so on, they had the maps out there. They came out eventually, the maps printed up in the US of oil pipelines that were going to go through all the different countries and where they were going to go and who would own them. The Ukraine is still going on. Why didn't the U.S. is in Ukraine with the scandals going on there with the U.S. Politicians and diplomats filling their pockets with all kinds of goodies and so on, and gas pipelines. And these things go on all the time. We're kind of oblivious in our little worlds because you're kept in an oblivious little world of make-believe and fantasy and stacks of awful entertainment. Generally, it's awful. It's getting worse all the time. You're not supposed to think any deeper. And in fact, you've been trained that it's none of your business what your betters, they used to call it, your betters are actually doing above you. What are you interested in that for? It's none of your business. Leave it to people who know what they're doing, you see? And that's what you're trained to do, really. In fact, even you know it works. This indoctrination really works when your own peer group, maybe members of your own family, say, what do you care about that for anyway? Yeah. And you say, well, I think it's important, isn't it? It affects us all. They say, oh, don't fill your head with that kind of... And that shows you they're gone. Their indoctrination and training... The conquering of their mind, because it's a trained mind, is exactly how it was designed to be by the elite. They had the right kind of so-called education, you see, indoctrination, and it's been reinforced all through their lives through bits and bytes, I call it, from the media. That's how they get little bits and bytes of information. I think Jack's Elal mentioned that people must learn from then on, once they're into adulthood, it's just updating them, and it's done by osmosis. It's not that they think deeply about it, and it's not their fault, by the way. Huh? It's not that they think deeply about the topics. They don't see why they should think any further than what they're told to believe by the media, like Brzezinski said, same thing. Yeah? And I used to wonder as a child, the TV, after any debate about anything or any speech by a politician, you would always have two opposing sides of people who would specialise in politics. And they would give you their interpretation of what they just heard. And they'd sort of debate it. And you'd say, well, I never heard any of them say that. You know, it didn't matter. Because what it was designed to do, and with the collusion of the two experts, by the way, It took years and years before anybody admitted to any of this kind of stuff. But the whole idea was to shape your opinion as a listener and say, well, that's reasonable. And then they would bring you to the conclusion they wanted you to have, you see. You never had better examples when it did come to the idea of the European Union and so-called free trade and all that kind of stuff. I mean, folks still didn't, still voted no. They said, we're going to keep bringing it back to the table every 6 months until you vote correctly, you see. So much for your democracy. So the elite have had their way for an awful long time. In the education system, they make sure you're given the right indoctrination. See, Bill Gates, I said that the man has his fingers in so many pies. It's just this, he just loves us all so much, you know. He doesn't want us to be too many of us, like his daddy, you know, the same thing. He's very concerned about that. But he also wants you to be healthy for if you manage to survive, you know, and live. He wants you to be healthy. But he'd rather you didn't, you weren't able to breed. I mean, he'd like that, you know. It's, what's wrong with that idea? I mean, H.G. Wells said it. He worked for the same organization, Wells, long before him. And Wells said it. He says, we used to think that, you know, we'd have to really kill them off. All he's talking about the useless people at the bottom, that the defunct, obsolete type. That's what H.G. Wells in A Modern Utopia. But he goes through this fictional travel by train and so on to different places in this advanced system. And Wells said, we used to think we'd have to kill them all, but we decided to be more humane and just sterilize them so that that generation would just die off. And of course, they wouldn't reproduce. That's what he said. And again, folk have a hard time disliking H.G. Wells. He wrote such wonderful stories, you know. He did. And entertained us. So we forgive awful things being planned for us because we like to be entertained at the same time. Is that logical? Well, see, folk haven't been taught critical thinking, how to really analyse problems before they're even problems. If you really could, you may prevent a lot of the problems, but you're not taught that in logic as well. You're not taught that at all. The simple, there's so many instances you're given of logic being abused. And they give you analogies and so on. But you had, you know, Rome, you had burning. While Nero fiddled, you know. In a way, it's like saying the same thing. It can all go to hell if you're being entertained well along the way, like H.G. Wells, you know. We're given happy songs at times. It's not all sad. Or nonsensical ones, mind you, but it doesn't matter, you know. And they're catchy little ditties. Catchy ones. That movie, it was called Oh, What a Lovely War. It was a musical type and movie. It's a satirical display of how it's all used against ordinary people, even for warfare. But in the movie, they go through the wonderful little war songs are churned out like by a machine almost, you know, just like you had in 1984, where songs and pornography were just churned out by machines. Now, of course, we have computers that automatically churn them out, but that's coincidence. But the in Over a Lovely War, they show you the basic, simplest techniques of how you recruit young guys in any country, doesn't matter what country it is. You have the same little basic instincts to protect your nation and your people and all that, and you join up. And you're all going to be home before Christmas, you know that. Huh? And they've catchy little songs, but whiz bangs, the types of shells that would get fired above you and over you and towards you and on you. That's songs for everything, you see, including being in the trenches and covered in mud and happy little things like that, you know. So, because the last thing you want is for folk to say, "But goodness sake, do you see what's happening at the front there? Our Tommy's been in the trenches for 3 years and his feet are rotten off with trench foot. And he's living with all these bits and pieces of corpses from previous battles that get buried in the mud and stuff. He didn't want you thinking about that. They want you thinking about, does your chewing gum lose its flavour on the bedpost overnight? And things like that. Silly little ditties, you see. And they churn them out like crazy. Yeah, they do. That type of song. I don't know if it's actually, but that type of song. Silly little things, you see. And it works awfully well, really. Because young guys are young guys. No young guy joins up to die. It's impossible he's going to die. He's at his prime of his life. He can jump walls, for goodness sake, and be as happy and all that kind of thing. You know, he's not even going to get old. Even if he lives 60 years, he's not going to be. It just doesn't happen to folk like him. It doesn't happen. You know? And so they join up in every country and they go off. And the basic propaganda, it's the first rule, is they must be given the most simplest propaganda. It's a rule. Everything happens in life, it's been studied, and there are rules for all. It could be simple propaganda. If you could just use those guys here are bad, that'd be good enough. So you don't go too far beyond that. Because if you go into any complexities, they might start to analyse and say, for goodness sake, and try to pick it apart. So you don't want that. Make it simple and ridiculous at times, just simple. And that's good enough. And they go off and they do what they were told to do. Because wars are awfully good at culling the population, you see. And for those who are in charge of the culling of the population, you get the wars gone. It's awfully profitable too. You understand where I heard the people. And I really do like the writings of characters in the past that touch on it, no matter if they're a bit... off the wall at times, or again too, is a lot more satirical. But Charles Fort said that we're farmed. He says, "I think we're farmed, and we are farmed like any animal." Which means, if you're farmed, there's farmers. And what do farmers do? Well, they keep charge. They're in charge of the stock. That's you. You're part of the stock. They know everything about you. They know your maw and your paw is. They know what your feelings would be. Oh, your maw, your paw is probably this and that and the whole thing, and so is your grandpa or grandma. Yeah, that's how they work it out, you see. That's what you do with husbandry, animal husbandry. And every farmers generally would know the exact lineage is going way back in their generations off their cattle and their sheep and all the rest of it. Just like beekeepers are famous for that. They go right into eugenics, big time. And that's why the beehive is the first thing that was built for the Royal Society. This big elite club that decides what reality is for all the rest of us. And they built a beehive, a glass one, to watch the perfect society, eh? With the monarch there running all at the top. And then the worker bee types, the bottom. But in between that, you got the drones that were kind of our priesthood that literally selected what you were going to be by what they fed you. And they thought that was wonderful. And it wasn't a novel idea. It goes all the way back even to ancient Egypt. They had the same thoughts then. But what makes these peasants here on this part of the Nile a bit taller than the other peasants up the Nile a bit further on, you see? And things like that. Studying, always studying what you own, and that includes the people. So when you take Prince Philip is a very honest about eugenics, and his talks at the different Sierra Club meetings he has, and world meetings with the different groups that he's a kind of chairman of, or he's probably retired now and handed it over to Charles, Charlie Boy. Or one of the other ones. He's quite open about it. He says, well, you know, sometimes when we have a problem. We have a problem when you see too many deer growing up on the estate, you know. And they start chewing the bark from the trees and destroying the trees. And we have to do something about it, you know. And sure enough, they go off in mass shoots and things. Or you can introduce in other countries wolves, of course. They've done that in the States, in Yellowstone Park at one point. And the problem is the wolves won't apply by killing all the deer off and everything else. And they killed everything else off. I mean, wolves will kill fox and every other competing animal and eat them as well. But no, the eugenists have no problems talking about that. Says, you'll find even the grass, you see, the grass changes too. And someday it'll come in and eat particular types of grass and right down to the dirt, you see. And they say, you know, you've got a plague of insects growing there. And so they go through this whole scenario of this domino effect, you see. And but what he was referring to along the way was, well, when there's too many people, it's the same problem. No. And so these are the characters that send you off to war and make sure that they profit, because they're farmers. You got to profit off the animals. You think we're all in it together, really? Really? Huh? Do you really think that? No, they're not in it. They cause it and they run it all, but they make sure they profit from you. Big time. And these wars are very, very profitable. For every bit of cloth, for every it's going to encase whatever animal it is, a human animal, that gets killed. I mean, that means a new recruit has to come up with get new equipment, new cloth, and all the rest of it, new belt buckles and gear and kit and you name it. That's very profitable, awfully profitable. And there's no questions asked in war. Everybody have got to suffer and ration and just accept it. Because we're all going to get killed. Well, in the process, a lot of you getting killed anyway, you see. But that doesn't matter. Terror is the greatest thing to get folk to give up all their rights and freedoms. Hitler said it too. And he got it. He saw the same thing because he studied the communists that had taken over the Bolsheviks in Russia. You know, the terror, reign of terror, you see. And the people can't think straight. It paralyzes them. It does. It paralyzes them. He said that. They can't think straight when they're terrorizing. And that's always been known by... And Napoleon knew it too, mind you. But that's the kind of thing that... that's a sort of technique that's used upon us. So terror is a great thing. You're all going to die, right? It gets you along. You're all going to die of something you can't even see. Oh, my God. Oh, my God, eh? And they go along with that too, and away it goes, eh? It works every time. And you're trained. Why would you suspect of being conned? Do you realize you're trained to be naive for your entire life? Hopefully, that's what they want. Because it's horrific to think what they're doing. It's something nefarious and nasty against you. Aren't they your own people? Are they? And so you believe it. And you're all being taught to respect the people. It's like being in the military. You get a whole series of command from NCOs all the way up, you see, private NCOs all the way up. And then you get all the ribbons and things. And you get, they used to call it scrambled egg on your skip, your cap, and things like that. And so you were taught to constantly to respect people with more spaghetti or scrambled egg on the skip of their cap and the beautiful, the gold lanyards and stuff like that. It was really amazing how you're trained, you see. But today they give you all these people with professors with a whole string of letters behind them. They could even have be to do with back scratching or something. You know, it doesn't matter as long as they've got all the letters there. And as long as they're introduced with the proper importance, you see. And you'll sit back and go, oh my God, this person says we're all going to die unless we just give up all our rights immediately. Right? Mm-mm-mm. Back in the 90s, I gave the talk about the high priests that others have copied since, recently too. And that from the ancient days, and India was famous too, and across the Middle East, but you don't think it, India was famous too. You see the old observatories they have that built there for studying the stars, just like Latin America, some parts there much later on, but India was way ahead of them. And of course you find the standing stones in Britain and the Shetlands as well, and up north of Scotland. They're all over the place to measure and basically guide or watch the stars, you know. It gave them their seasons and their time and everything else. But again, good priests could, and they've used it in different movies, like fictional movies. Good priests would also know when eclipses would happen. And they'd warn the people and say, you know, if you don't cough up more of your jewelry here, and maybe a few of your daughters extra this month, the sun's going to, on this day, the sun's just going to go black. And only we can stop it. And so they get all the treasury thrown at them, you know, the folks' treasures and stuff. And sure enough, when would come the eclipse, and the priest would stand up in his fine robes and stuff and do mumbo jumbo to dispel it. And he'd say, appear, and sure enough, the light would come on, eh? The light would come back on. And that was awfully important and really impressed upon us. It was a good show. It was a great show. Yeah. And that's how they used to do it. Knowledge is power, remember. That's what do you mean, that knowledge is definitely power. Of course it is. So we live through a system where they bring on the people who are supposed to have the knowledge. And the last thing you're going to believe is that there's a big con game going on here. Why would anybody? Because you wouldn't do this. You wouldn't do it. You might tell a little white lie, but it's impossible to tell a massive lie to shut down a country or a nation's economy and way of living. Hey? So it must be true what they're telling you. Because you couldn't, you could never, you might do a little deceptive thing, but you would never, you slipped in, and that's the whole trick of it. And Hitler mentioned that, and Hitler copied it from others that had done it before him. because Machiavellis are always there in every country. And you can bring them in from other countries to advise leaders. And that's what these characters do. They've got these ready-made Machiavelli characters, well steeped in the history of chronology, how to con the public and use them. So, why would you think they're going to lie to you? Why would you think that, eh? There's a guy in Britain, when I was a really young, and he came on, he was a comedian, but he was also introduced as a professor. And he came on there, and he would use a kind of Leica impressive technique of persuasion with the proper, with a Leica vocabulary, and make up stuff of nonsense as he went along, which would sound awfully convincing, the little bits and pieces you could make out amongst all the of the highfalutin terminology he was using. But it was very impressive. And he went on for years with this act of his, awfully good, because he was showing you the techniques that were used to impress you and to make you think, I'm a silly little fool. And he's a really genius talking to you here. He was showing you the techniques that were always used upon you. Quite amazing, eh? Quite amazing. It really is. And it's true enough. Why would ordinary, in a tribal situation, I've given this example before, in a small tribe, even if you're a size tribe, say like a Zulu nation at one time, children would feel safe because the rules were simple, but they're known to everybody what the rules of the tribe were, you see. And so you would always know what to expect and what to see. Anything out of the ordinary didn't fit in, would scare you, you see. And the children looked to the adults for guidance, to be safe. And what to touch, what not to touch, what will eat them, what won't eat them, and things like that. And that's what security is. But that can only work in a tribal situation. Once you give over your children to outside authorities with its political and social agendas, it's just different altogether. Those who rule the world have always planned, often a century and a half, maybe two centuries ahead. Actually longer than that, in fact, but I'm talking about the media projects and stuff that they're working on at any one time. Like a big business plan. And they know exactly, as I said before, in one way.